From years of anxiety to warrior and mentor, Bradley Robinson created the Anxiety Project to help you end your anxiety naturally. Let's mold the new you and let's end anxiety together.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Anxiety Project podcast. Here we are on episode 285, and I have a guest today. Her name, Nicole Vinola. She's so interesting, man. We talked so much about anxiety and the brain structures and how we can rewire our brain to make us less anxious and to get us out of a rut, out of that corner that we tend to find periodically in our lives. She's a neuroscientist, corporate consultant, author, and speaker committed to making neuroscience tangible for the masses. Her first book, Rewire Your Toolkit for Everyday Life, and is now available. So we talk about her book, and I read her book, and it's great, and I highly recommend it. It's simple for those who don't want to go and study neuroscience. It's a simplified version of how these pathways all interconnect and how they contribute to the chaos we experience on a day-to-day basis. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Let me know what you think. Please head on over to YouTube for the video version and leave your comments, but also rate this podcast here on Spotify. I'd greatly appreciate it. And so, without a further ado, let's dive into this interview. Welcome to the Anxiety Project podcast. I am excited to have you here. You have a background in neuroscience, mm-hmm. which I'm really excited to talk to you about. And so, as my viewers know, I love talking about anxiety every week. So I want to dive into the weeds of the functioning of the brain when it comes to anxiety, the unconscious mind. But I want to start off with this question: how you got into this? I mean, what interested you in this?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's great. Well, I don't know. I get asked this question a lot. A variety of things. My father was schizophrenic with bipolar disorder, and I was just always sort of deeply fascinated by the inner workings of the mind. And, you know, instead of blaming him for his behaviors, it was quite enlightening understanding from a neuroscientific perspective and psychological as well, what was going on, you know. So I think from a young age, I was sort of deeply fascinated with how brains are different. You know, it's one person can behave in a particular way and another person another way, but it's all sitting inside your skull. So no one ever really sees it. No one sees your mental health the way that they see, you know, your physical health, perhaps, you know, not always, but it's a generalization. So yeah, I was, amazed by that, really.
Where'd you study?
I studied at the University of Bristol. Do you know it?
No. How was it?
The hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. and to be honest, I went to school 8 years after finishing high school. I was 26, going on 27 when I started. So I feel like I spent the first year of neuroscience just actually learning how to learn. I was struggling to sort of retain information. I was also, you know, I was an adult. I was going through my own breakup, and I got dumped 2 days into my new journey of university. So it was all a lot to navigate mentally, physically. First year was really hard. And then second year I was playing catch up. And then by third year I got my stride. It was amazing. I loved it. But it was very hard.
you must have learned a lot about yourself, learning about all of that. I mean, about how your brain works, how your anxiety works, your stress, all of that.
More in my master's, actually, because by then I'd kind of had the undergraduate sort of foundation, which I actually thought was useless when I finished it. I was like, ooh, if I just spent, you know, loads of money on a degree that I'm never going to use. I had a very sort of existential crisis because I didn't want to work in research. I didn't want to work in a lab. But then I went on to do my master's. And I think having that foundation, that's when I then had the freedom to sort of start analyzing my life and my choices. And maybe I did it whilst doing neuroscience as well without my conscious knowledge, but definitely throughout my master's, I sort of started to pay attention to particular things, and in therapy, sort of putting two and two together. My master's was actually in something completely different. My undergraduate research was in neuroplasticity, and then my master's research was more attention and cognitive energy, how we spend our cognitive resources essentially. So everything you do requires some level of energy, regardless of what it is. So it's just about being mindful as to where you put your energy. So my particular research was looking at how we perceive social media to be a mental break during work hours, but it's not necessarily a mental break. It's actually taking more energy from your brain. So then you go back to your work thinking, oh, I've just had a whole 1 hour break, but you're not actually recovered or replenished. So it's, you know, none of it is bad. It's just paying attention to where you put your energy.
I think that's a great way. That's great, because I want to ask you now, the age of anxiety that we're living in. I mean, it's anxiety is at an all-time high. I mean, everyone at one point in their life experiences anxiety to a great, great debilitating degree. But I feel like it's more prominent now. And like you were talking about the not recharging, the glass is full.
Yeah.
It's overflowing. And when I had an anxiety disorder in my 20s, the glass was full of emotion. And when I would get, like, say, a ticket, right? I would just burst into tears. Like, and I'm like, wow, I'm so pathetic. I'm crying over this. I was just so reactive, so sensitive, because my life was in complete chaos. What's going on today in this age of anxiety, people's glasses overflowing? Why do you think it's getting worse?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an economist, but I'd like to think that we are living in unprecedented times after the pandemic and cost of living. I don't know where you are. You're in New York, right?
In Canada.
Right. In the UK, it's crazy. You know, people are getting outpriced from London flats. My sister had to leave the UK because she just couldn't afford to raise her child there anymore. They got kicked out of the flat. Was sort of £1,600 per month for one-bedroom flat. And the prices have gone up. They were being outbid by £3,000, you know, almost double the price. So it's, I'm not an economist. I can't say for certain. This is purely my opinion on what is going on, but I do believe that we are living in very, very stressful times with financial crises. But in terms of neuroscience, so I love what you said about the cup being half full. So just to give that a little bit of explanation so that people can understand. So your central nervous system has a function to do parasympathetic activity, which is relax, digest, etc., and then sympathetic activity, which is, you know, fight or flight, but not necessarily fight or flight. It's things like exercise, moving, thinking. We're probably a little bit sympathetic right now. We need a level of activation to operate, right? And what that means is that your central nervous system needs to be ready to shift between one state or another. Now, we call that heart rate variability. It's actually the variability of heartbeats, of sort of beat between your heart beats. So what that means is if your heart rate is sort of 60 beats per minute, it's not 60 exactly on the second, 1, 1, 1. It's probably 1.2, 1.4, 0.8 seconds every time it beats. The variability in those numbers, the bigger that number is, the better your central nervous system is working. So you want your heart rate variability to be higher. Anyone that has a trackable, like an Apple Watch or a Whoop or a Garmin or any of that sort, you can also get apps. There's an app called Heart Rate Variability Training or something. You pay £8 for it and it's a one-off payment. You can actually track this. And it basically tells you how ready your central nervous system is. And if I just break it down into much simpler terms, if you think about it as like a web, your central nervous system is a spider web. Now you have things pulling on it. You don't have enough sleep. You're ill. You're super stressed. You haven't replenished that cup. Things are pulling on that spider web. If you then poke a hole in the middle of it when there's not enough tension or enough give in the spider web, it's going to break. And that's what was happening with you with the tickets. It was just your spider web was so tense and pulling on so many things were pulling on it that even a simple thing can send you off into a frenzy. And I wrote about that in my book, a couple of my own experiences with that, you know. And what I want people to understand is that it's not you, you know, it's not that you're pathetic or you have no mental resilience. It's that your cup and your spider web is quite literally straining. Your central nervous system hasn't got enough give to give to the unexpected. The problem is that the unexpected is in our lives all of the time, right? Yeah. And that's, I think, very validating when people hear that. They go, okay, so it's not me, it's my central nervous system, or it's not me, it's my brain. And the good thing is that, you know, these things can all recover and change and become more resilient over time. But, you know, obviously we need to tackle the root causes and implement strategies that can help us alleviate all that stress and improve our heart rate variability, mental resilience.
Right. No, that's beautifully said. I love that analogy of the spider's web. It's perfect. When someone is experiencing severe anxiety, panic, and their sympathetic nervous system is active all the time, they can't sleep, you know, the monsters come out at night. I like to call it that because, you know, when it's finally just them and their own minds, it's like torture. So where do people go from there when they would come to you, or even with your own personal journey, when things are so chaotic, you're experiencing all of this anxiety? Where are the steps forward from that chaos and into some sort of goal-directed aim? Like just like giving that person like, oh, maybe this could actually work, or I could actually get better. Like, where do they go?
Yeah, I know.
It's complicated because it's always a context by context thing. I understand that. But like, I guess like a more of like a roadmap. Towards.
Yes. And I'd like to just point out that I'm not a clinical psychologist, but you know, it's funny because us neuroscientists have this sort of predicament all the time. And I was talking about it with a fellow neuroscientist because she's writing a book as well. And she was kind of having this major imposter syndrome. And we kind of came to the conclusion that if we give people a manual on how to operate, then they can go to their therapist and already kind of know how the manual operates in one way or another. So just wanted to sort of mention that. But you know, there are a couple of things. So one thing is stress and anxiety are separate but anchored in the same system. So one of the questions I always ask people is it stress or is it anxiety? Because if it's stress, when we can accurately name our emotions, the source of where they're coming from, the root problem and how we could potentially solve it, that gives us a sense of autonomy. That actually recruits the frontal cortex, that part of the brain that's responsible for decision-making, top-down regulation. It can help you be more resilient in a situation, provided that it's active. So, you know, one of the things that I hear people say a lot, and I've wrote about in the book, is that we use stress, anxiety, worry interchangeably. Now, of course, anxiety is probably the majority of the people that listen to your podcast are suffering with panic disorders or anxiety disorders. But just for anyone that's maybe sitting on that spectrum, it is helpful to really analyze what it is that you're feeling. And one way to know the difference is if it's stress, if you have to remove the thing that's causing the anxiety or the stress, if you had to remove it, would that feeling go away? That's probably stress. If it doesn't, it's probably anxiety. Anxiety can be triggered internally without any external force, whereas stress is generally a deadline, looming deadline, you know, financial worries, which can overlap with anxiety, of course, as well. But clinical anxiety doesn't generally have a root cause. And that's one identifiable way to figure out whether, you know, to get more professional help. Right. Mm-hmm. And I find that actually helps people because now they understand the mechanisms of what's going on in the body. Now, anxiety can trigger stress. It can raise cortisol. It can raise your adrenaline, and it can make you hypervigilant because your threat detection center in the brain, the amygdala, is responsible for detecting threatening stimuli in your environment. When stress levels are higher and when you're anxious as well, those threat detections become more pervasive is not the right word, but frequent. So the brain starts attaching fear to things that shouldn't be fearful. So one of the things that can really help, as I said, so step number one is maybe really identifying where the source of this is coming from. Another problem with anxiety is that generally it's not a lack of problem solving skills in the sense that you don't have them, but perhaps the problem you have has not got a problem. And that's where the issue really arises, because as humans, we want to be in control. We want to be able to find solutions to our problems. So if it's a money problem and you don't have more money, but you have your bills that you need to be paid, that can be extremely, you know, damaging to yourself, because then everything else, hypervigilance is increased. So, you know, step number two is step number one, identifying. Step number two was activating or recruiting the correct brain areas again. So again, bringing on that frontal cortex back on by identifying, but also trying to problem solve with the solution. So if there is a solution, this is where it gets tricky, because anxiety is rooted in wanting to solve a problem that may not necessarily have a problem solving solution to it. Okay, that might need cognitive interventions from professionals to help with maybe even realigning our the way that we perceive stress and the way that we perceive the outcome of our worries. Because sometimes, and I'm using money as an example because that's generally speaking a lot of people's problems, right, is money issues. So it might be that it needs a budgeting solution. Could you find ways that you could minimize costs? Could you find ways to, and once we start actually getting into the problem solving again, you're recruiting that frontal cortex again, and not just recruiting it, you're also strengthening it. So when you strengthen the problem solving skills, and this is, you know, people always laugh saying, oh, all that math that I did at school didn't solve anything, it was useless, but actually it wasn't, because it was helping the brain create pathways to help you problem solve later in life, even if it wasn't exactly what we did in school, which was Pythagoras theorem. It's an invaluable skill to be able to problem solve. So helping people, because one of the other issues with anxiety and stress and thoughts, ruminating thoughts, is that these thoughts and worries and stress, they all arise in bigger parts of the brain and areas of the brain that take up the whole brain. What that means is that generally speaking, thoughts don't have a beginning and an end. Can you resonate with that? Because I know it sounds weird when I say that, but when I say that, people kind of get this penny drop and they go, It is. When I try and put it into words, sometimes it's hard, because thoughts can really take up our whole mind and communicate with different areas of the brain that give us a sense of feeling, but not necessarily a sense of logic.
Exactly.
And as soon as we start writing it down, as soon as we start journaling, as soon as we talk about it with a friend, as soon as we try to start solving the problem, we start to see that there's more cohesive beginning and end to our issue. So you've got money issues. Okay, how can we tackle this instead of lying in bed at night worrying about this and not actually coming up with a solution? The other problem is that when you're lying in bed at night worrying about it, you're not actually being constructive. You've got higher emotions. Your stress levels are higher. Your serotonin is higher at night. We've got three phases to the day. So phase number one is your first 8 hours. That is when you have more norepinephrine, more dopamine. So you're more motivated. You're more likely to go for your morning run. And in the evening, you're more serotonergic. So the second 8 hours. And then the last 8 hours is your sleep. But the second 8 hours, that's where you have more serotonin getting ready to create melatonin, getting ready to put you to bed. But serotonin is more emotional. And again, I put that in inverted commas, but that's why we can start to catastrophize, ruminate, really excessively worry. So put in a plan of action, you know, okay, at 6 o'clock, I know once that food's kicked in and social media's, you know, rampant, I'm tired from the day, I want to get into bed. I'm tired. I can't sleep. Then that's another worry. You know, I personally worry that I won't be able to sleep. And then I just don't sleep. Right. So putting that plan in place, preparing for that setback, knowing that that's going to happen, means you're better equipped and giving your brain a way to divert those thoughts. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I know I'm worried about money, but we made that plan. We made that financial plan. And that financial plan shows us that actually we should be okay by the end of the month if we do this, this, and this, and that. That gives you a sense of control again.
That's it. It's a sense of control. That's what I desperately needed. Really, it was about, and you talked about this in the book too, which I highly recommend everyone to check out because it's a great book. And I want to dive more into the rewiring of that, the neural pathways, and how you can actually break free from the defeating narratives that we all have. But I feel like, Nicole, for me, it was about that order, the structure. It was about adding because I noticed I was in complete chaos. Everything mm-hmm. that, you know, I could do every day to mitigate, because I look at it like sacrifices towards chaos itself, because mm-hmm. what I was making the wrong sacrifices. I was saying, well, I need reassurance so I can feel better. I need, alcohol medications to feel better. I need a constant attention. I need whatever it was, pornography, or it was just distractions, Netflix, to feel better, TV at 2 a.m. to feel better. And I noticed that it was getting worse. It was getting a lot worse. So I love that. And it kind of brings me into this default mode network you were talking about in the book, which is so, I love this because you say how this is related to negative narratives and what you pay attention. Is it what is relevant to you? So talk about that. That's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that kind of aligns. No, it doesn't kind of align. Sorry, I need to stop saying that. It aligns with what I just said about the thoughts taking up big cortical areas in the brain. So your default mode network is exactly what the word says. Default mode of thinking. What's your automatic? When you're washing the dishes, what's going through your mind? When you're lying in bed at night, what's going through your mind? Generally speaking, we can rewire that default mode network to essentially be whatever we want it to be. But just like we have to exercise our muscles in the gym, we have to exercise our brain. It's just harder because we can't see the progress like you can by weighing yourself, measuring your muscles, etc. But the default mode network is a place of either mind-wandering creativity, internal thoughts, autobiographical memories. What are you thinking about when you're thinking about nothing? But it can also be the place of rumination. And I describe it in a way that's kind of like it's your garden. And what have you planted? Because if you've planted negative thoughts, negative thinking, and then reinforced patterns of anxiety as well, then that is what the brain knows best, because the brain doesn't know the difference between right and wrong. And this is huge. When I say that to people, they're like, oh my gosh, so it's not me, it's my brain, right? And it gives us, again, that sense of control, because people attribute their ailments to something being wrong with them as a person. You know, we need to detach the identity from what's been repeated. The brain does what it does best. Whatever's been repeated is what it's going to repeat every single time, unless you decide to change that programming. And the default mode network is an area of the brain that you can reprogram. So you can program it to be less negative, less anxious, less ruminative, more creative, more inspired. It's a place of inspiration. It just, you know, it takes time. So that's why in the book, I've got the whole phase one where we learn how to ditch the negative, how to rewire those negative thoughts, how to reprogram them into something else. Now, one of the things that is the biggest sort of penny drop for people when I say this to them is your brain works on a cue, trigger, reward. Sometimes anxiety can actually fall into a habit loop. If you look up Dr. Judd's work, I don't know if you've ever looked at any of his stuff. He's a psychiatrist from Brown University. He has a book on anxiety. I definitely recommend you get him on here because he's great. He wrote a whole book called The Anxiety Loop or something. Yeah. And Untangling Anxiety. Here we go. Beautiful. And what that means is that your brain will see a particular thing in the environment. Let's use the clock. It's 5 o'clock. That's your time to smoke. That's your time where everything finishes and now you're anxious. Okay. But it triggers you to then do a particular behavior, which is either smoke or be anxious. But when we then use that cue for something else, we can remind ourselves to do something more positive. So what I tell people to do is attach the positive to the end of the negative if you forget to do it. So what that means is when 5 o'clock strikes and you get that cue and you still ruminate or you still smoke the cigarette, instead of beating yourself up about it, because that's another thing, instead add something positive. Okay, I just did all of that, but that's fine because Nick said that I should add something positive to the end of that sequence. So whether that be a stretch, a glass of water, maybe it's the physiological sigh, a breathing technique that helps you, you know, lower your stress system. That means that now, eventually, what will happen is that cue will trigger something positive. Even if not right in the beginning, after a while, you'll be able to bypass it because you're going to know that sequence. You're going to know, okay, the sequence is 5 o'clock, cigarette, breathing. And then eventually you're going to go, 5 o'clock actually triggers me to do something really good for myself. Let's bypass that. And you can start dismantling that firing pattern.
That's rewiring. That's it. And how's that associated with, because you talk about the importance of imagining alternative outcomes. So this is something I did in my recovery where I would sit in the morning and I would imagine how I would want the day to play out if I knew that there would be those periods of chaos. Like, oh my God, because I suffered from agoraphobia at one point where I knew I had to go to a concert with my wife. And I was like, oh no, that's going to trigger that panic. And so I would sit and imagine how I would play it out. Why is that so important? What's going on to make it so useful and effective?
Couple of things. Again, by playing it out, you can give yourself a sense of control. So you can plan out all the things that are going to go wrong and how you can fix them. So not just sort of going off on a trajectory and worrying about all the things that could go wrong, but actually when we do that in a state of solution to the problem, we're actually, again, recruiting different parts of the brain that don't make us spiral. So people always ask me, they're like, oh, but if I start doing that, I'm just going to go off on a trajectory and spiral down. So, you know, write it down, talk it out loud, maybe, you know, bullet point it in your head if you're more imaginative, because it helps you actually find a solution to the problem. Okay, I'm going to go to this concert. I know that I get stressed out around people. Okay, so then in that case, I can do my breathing, you know, or whatever it is. You know, I'm just sort of throwing out examples here. I then get stressed out by these things. So I'm going to then do X, Y, Z. And then you've got a plan. You've got a mental plan. So you're preparing for setbacks. Now, visualizing these things can actually help start creating new synapses in the brain, new pathways in the brain. I talk about this study all the time, and there was many more after this, but in 1995, Dr. Pasquale Leone did a series of experiments where he took two groups of people. He asked one group of people to play a five-finger piece on the piano. They'd never played the piano before. And then group number two had to imagine that they were playing that five-finger piece on the piano. And what they saw is that they had the same levels of synaptic plasticity in the motor cortex. So their motor cortex that actually dictates how their fingers are going to move or already starting to create pathways on how to play the piano, which is pretty wild because they only thought about it, the one group. And that shows us that we can start creating new pathways in the brain through thought alone. That's why we also can go into spirals. That's why we can go into spirals of negative thinking, you know. And I say that with people who maybe jump to negative conclusions. They see something positive on an Instagram feed and they already have a negative response to it. You know, those kind of things are practiced behaviors as well. And by visualizing it, we can actually start changing that narrative, start introducing a different solution to our brain, a different possibility of how we could be in the future. And then through reinforcing it, we have to physically reinforce it by acting it out. So going to the concert and giving yourself evidence that everything was okay and that you were in control when things didn't go okay, or you had a backup plan for when things weren't okay, that shows to our brain that there's evidence we can do this. And that's how you increase resilience. That's how you start rewiring your brain to be, you know, more prepared.
It's brilliant. I love the cognitive triangle you laid out in the book, where your thoughts lead to emotions, emotions lead to behaviors, and thoughts can direct you into bad posture, habits. Talk about that triangle, because once people see this, the simplicity of it, they can use that to their advantage to rewire themselves.
Yes. Just to backtrack, better prepared, it's because I also want people to understand that you get stronger with all the information. The anxiety may not ever fully go away. You just get better at dealing with it as well. But yes.
Absolutely.
So, And I love that analogy, just that saying, that thought, that notion, because we are better equipped to deal with life's adversities. But the cognitive triangle, again, you know, potentially oversimplified back in the 80s, but it's a wonderful way to show that. So your behaviors affect your emotions affect your actions, and then they all affect one another. So if you are, let's say you are shy, You want to walk into a coffee shop. Now you walk into the coffee shop with your body language all closed, you know, and then your emotions are, you know, telling you that, you know, you should be shy, and then your feelings and behaviors are acting out this level of shyness. And then there's an added layer to this that, you know, kind of reinforces that, is that perhaps the barista behind the coffee counter interprets that you're shy. So they are acting a bit awkward because they don't want to make you feel more awkward. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I really am awkward. They can even tell I'm awkward. And it's just this kind of like snowball effect of reinforcing pattern, you know. And one of the things you can do is just, you know, practice that body language outside. Like, I feel a particular way. But I'm still going to stand there with my shoulders up and my head held high, no matter what I'm feeling. And then in turn, you start seeing, again, this evidence. The brain wants evidence. You go into the coffee shop, you order the coffee. The barista's fine with you now because he doesn't interpret you to be shy, maybe a bit quiet. That's fine. And then you go, okay, that's the evidence that actually perhaps I'm not as, you know, shy or weird. People think they're weird all the time. And one of the interesting things is that there was a research paper that was conducted in 2020 or 2021. People are liked more than they think they are. I think it was like over 80. I wrote about it in the book. I should remember the stats, but over 80% of the respondents said that they felt weird, silly, like the people that they were talking to didn't like them. But then I think it was 95% of the people responded that they really did like them. Which is, you know, crazy. It just goes to show how we have this perceived idea of how we are to the world, but we're not being perceived like that.
Absolutely. It ties back to what we were talking about earlier about doing things that you don't want to do, like go to the concert, because for me, it was not just the concert, but it was public places. And it ties into what you were saying about going to the coffee shop, where I was very socially anxious, and it was linked to agoraphobia. It was linked to my anxiety disorder, where it would just follow me around. But here's the thing, what's so cool is when I would slur or feel that way, where I would, oh no, they don't like me, I made a fool out of myself, I can't ever come back here. That was my thought pattern. And but I had a vision, Nicole. Like, my vision was, I knew who I was, because I was very aware that, oh no, I'm this anxious, shy guy. And so I started to be very hard on myself, where I don't like where I'm at. I hate it. So what if I did the opposite? What if I said, you know what? It doesn't matter if my brain tells me to not come back here. I'm going to come back here tomorrow anyways. And I started going back every day. Like, I was obsessed about not wanting to be the same man. I wanted to reinvent myself. So when my brain said, don't do it, I always did it.
Yeah.
And that's
goosebumps.
that's really it. I mean, because people ask me all the time, like, why do you do the morning routine that you do? Mm. And like, aren't you putting like a barrier up to running away from the anxiety rather than facing it? I'm like, no, that's not why I do my morning routine. It's so that I can put on my armor. I can be mentally present and reflexive in times of chaos. And because I'm running, because I'm going to the gym, because I'm taking an ice bath, because I'm meditating, that allows me to be cognizant, alert, and less reactive.
Yes.
My glass is very like that. So I have all this battery power to, chaos, like come at me. I've faced you like 100 times before.
Yes. And I love that you said you kept going back, because that's that repetition of wanting to close that gap between what your subconscious brain has always practiced, which is don't go to the coffee shop, you're weird, to I'm going to change this. And now, you know, our conscious brains are 5 to 10% of our actual brains. And then the majority of our brain operates on subconscious. And again, if you've been repeating this particular pattern, that's what's always going to take over, unless you say, I'm going to do it anyway. Because then eventually that will become your new normal. Those automatic pathways will now be to go to the coffee shop and not automatically think you're weird. You might have thoughts every now and again that you might be treading on that line again, but, you know, we're all a little bit weird in some ways anyway. So,
And you know, that's the other thing too, Nicole, is we're all fallible. And even the most toughest people that I've come across, they you can, the more you hang around really tough minded people, the more you see like they're just a person.
Yeah.
You know, and they welcome failure. They accept it. It's part of the process. And I think that's the failure aspect is so important for people too. Cause I want to be perfect. I don't want to fail. I want to meet all the check marks every day. I have to feel a certain way in order to function.
Yeah. And that's the biggest part of my, well, not biggest, but there's a big chapter on that as well. You know, the fear of failure and that attaching yourself again to the identity. I've got the whole chapter on growth mindsets. And the problem with fixed mindsets is that we attach ourselves to the outcome with a fixed mindset. So when we fail, we attribute it to ourselves. When we have a growth mindset, we know that failure is part of it, right? You're always going to fail. Failures, the way that I see it is, you know, your brain is a database of information that it's ever experienced and the solutions that it's always come up with and information. You don't have access to all of that information all of the time. Okay. You just don't, you can't ponder on a 9-year-old memory right now, but it can come to you spontaneously. And the way that I see failures is that it's just data that you're putting in to how things work. Okay, we did this, that went wrong. Let's not do that again. Because the brain has got a very good error detection area. It's not going to put you in situations where you're going to fail over and over. We know that because otherwise anxiety wouldn't exist. So failure is just another data point. It might hurt. You might feel like a fool a little bit. Maybe if you're disappointed at other people, that's not going to feel nice. But in the long run, you're gonna have that information. You're not going to do that again. You're going to be better equipped.
I love that. That's so brilliant because I'm the type of guy, Nicole, where I don't think many people are, to be honest, because the people I've coached, they're not. It takes them like maybe a year to finally cut the dragon loose. But I noticed with everyone that there's a period where they try and go a week, say, like I've coached a lot of men with pornography and they'll go like, maybe a week or maybe even like 2 days and then they'll relapse. But I'm like, well, how many times were you watching pornography before? Oh, twice a day. So you went a whole day or you went 2 days without it. Do you know how much of a percentage of improvement that is? And so it's like these micro movements.
Yes.
It's brilliant.
I love that because we actually learn better on positive reinforcement. We don't learn on negative reinforcement. So if we beat ourselves up about the fact that we watched porn after 2 days, your brain's not going to adjust to that. It's not going to go, oh, don't do that again. Because otherwise, if we did that, we wouldn't have any problems to begin with, right? We would have nipped it in the bud the first time we beat ourselves up about it. Yeah. So, you know, we learn better on positive reinforcement. So, wow, it's been a whole day and I haven't watched pornography. Amazing. Okay, day two. Okay, we relapsed. That's fine. That's fine. We've gone 2 days. Let's just get back on track. Because we want to, again, be in control. So what that tells us when we beat ourselves up about it is subconsciously we're saying to ourselves, it doesn't matter if we fail, because we can just beat up ourselves about it later. And that's our sense of gaining control over the situation. But obviously that doesn't work. So instead of beating yourself up, what if you actually analyze, why did you do it? Okay, you did this because you were feeling X, Y, Z. These are my triggers. This is what I'm going to do next time. If I fail, it's fine because I'm doing really great at only staying, you know, abstaining for 2 days. And then that's how you get better.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's nicely said because the fixed mindset is you being situated in a bubble of what's been repeated and what you know. And then when the person leaves that bubble and experiences a separation and there's that shift in perception, maybe that one day without the substance, they see something, they see a new side of themselves because it's difficult, but also they can, it's like they peer out of the side because there's an old, it's an ancient drawing of like a philosopher in the bubble and he's like looking outside into like the universe and there's all the stars and it, that like represents society, you know, like order and chaos surrounding it. So that, I think like that's the person really is they separate themselves from the substance. They can peer into a new domain of existence. They kind of see a different side of themselves. They actually may experience maybe something better. Like, hey, I actually feel pretty good. I don't feel as anxious or controlled. I don't feel like this thing is controlling me, which is actually, I think, the biggest thing about those substances. And then when they fail, they realize that it was actually better that I wasn't being controlled. It was better that I was in this place where I actually felt mentally clear. And that it's like failure is actually necessary for that reason, is it helps them realize that this is where I don't want to be in my life.
Yeah.
It's necessary. Yeah.
And fear is a necessary part of life. You know, we're never going to be able to escape it either. It's like stress. We're never going to be able to escape it. It's just, how do we equip ourselves? What armor, like you said, I love that you said you put on the armor. What armor can you carry with you, do you have to be able to then, you know, tackle this issue of failure?
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about this. You talked about this in your book, the anterior cingulate cortex.
Yes.
This is interesting. I wanted to ask you, when we're setting a goal and we're moving in the direction of the goal, is that the part of the brain that's active? It's interesting. I'm not really familiar with that.
Yeah. So the anterior cingulate cortex has many functions, but do you mean that in the terms of error detection? Because it's a big
error detection.
Yeah, is that what you meant?
Yes, because you did say that. Yeah, I remember you said error detection specifically. Yeah.
But it's also responsible for, so the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, neuroscience is very confusing, is responsible for growth mindset as well.
Growth mindset. Oh,
yeah. So we actually see it in, there's, I didn't get to put a visual in the book because it was just getting all very complicated with explaining it. But I linked the paper in the book where you can actually see, so when they took individuals through mindset training, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex was actually more active over 6 weeks. 6 to 8 weeks in the training. So it was actually increased in size, and that is responsible for being more resilient mentally. Now, the dorsal medial anterior cingulate cortex is responsible for, I haven't put this in the book, but there's too much to put in the book, but that is actually the part of the brain that's responsible for making you do things that you don't want to. So you can see how closely linked these things are. So, you know, I love that you said the ice bath. My partner always says it's the easiest way to do something hard. Because, you know, if you do something hard, you either have to hike or go to the gym or do something extreme, whereas ice is so obvious. It's right there. It sucks for a minute and a half. And then you're done. And it's this like slog of not wanting to do it, but then doing it anyway, that strengthens these parts of the brain that then eventually can, you know, communicate with other parts of the brain that help you to be more mentally resilient, have a bigger growth mindset, be able to overcome things that you don't want to, detect errors in your life and be better equipped to deal with them.
Detect errors. That's like Horace, you know, with the eye, you know, pay attention, always pay attention. And the philosophers like Marcus Aurelius would always talk about things like be disciplined every day, do something challenging every day. And with this mid-cingulate cortex, it grows in size.
Yes.
It grows. That's incredible. And it's correlated not just with willpower, but the will to live. That it and when I heard that, I was like, man, so when you go out for that run and you don't want to go for the run, you know, that part of the brain grows. And I've noticed with that part of the brain that it's small in people that are not disciplined, specifically like obese people. That part of the brain is very, very small. And to like people who are at the gym or doing the ice baths, it's pretty large. Incredible.
Okay, I haven't looked at the data on that specifically, but I would speculate that somewhere along, something like that. It's about, you know, doing the things you don't want to. Like, I love that you said you went to the concert anyway, because that's going to be strengthening that same area. And the other thing is that you're reinforcing self-trust. When you have self-trust, you have self-confidence. When you've got self-confidence, you've got confidence in the world. It's that triangle, you know. If your thoughts, you know, say that you're confident and strong within yourself, because if you can keep promises to yourself, then you've got everything, yeah, right? Absolutely. So it's not realistic. If you're going to say you're going to get up at 6, then get up at 6, yeah, you know, even if you have to get back into bed an hour later, I don't know, you know, but just do it. You have to be realistic with yourself, but you have to keep the promises to yourself as well. That's how you increase that mental resilience.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That, the anterior mid cingulate cortex, that's very new information. I heard it from like a latest Huberman podcast.
Dorsal medial.
Dorsal medial. Yes. Yes. So yeah, from what I've heard from Huberman, I think that's just like recent kind of, news and it just kind of cements in the fact that you were saying it's like, do something difficult and yeah, it increases your willpower. That's pretty much yeah, it. It's brilliant. And
you know, we're talking about neuroplasticity in the sense of creating new pathways, strengthening, but we can weaken synapses as well. So, you know, you can actually weaken the connections of anxiety loops and fear detection areas. So the amygdala actually becomes oversized in individuals that suffer with anxiety, but it can also shrink again. You know, we can do that through cognitive interventions, all the things we've spoken about now. Walking is a wonderful way to help reduce anxiety as well, because, you know, people kind of scoff at me when I say that, but when I explain the neuroscience, you kind of go, okay, that makes sense. So, you know, have you ever done EMDR therapy, or you've heard of EMDR therapy? Yeah. So that natural eye movement, moving side to side, actually deactivates the amygdala because it's competing for resources. The frontal parietal networks that dictate the opticokinetic nystagmus, which is
that's your... That's the mouthful. I can't even believe you remember that.
It's basically what your eyes are doing when you're walking through the world and imagery are moving past you. Your eyes aren't physically moving side to side, but they are in one way or another. Have you ever been, you don't have the underground, you've ever been on the train and you watch people's eyes? I love watching people's eyes. Whenever we approach the underground station, people's eyes go and they go crazy. They don't realize that that's happening. I can see that it's happening because that is what it is. But that lateral eye movement, which is obviously not happening to that degree when you're walking in the world, but that lateral eye movement is actually switching off the amygdala. That's why going for a walk can help, in inverted commas, clear your mind, you know, help you reason with the issue and then come back to it at a later date with a more sort of clear reasoning. Because it's actually, you know, that frontal parietal network that dictates the eye movement competes for resources with the amygdala. And if the amygdala isn't active, it's going to start weakening the synapses over time.
Hmm.
You know?
Interesting. That is fascinating. I learned this from CBT. I was walking around with an elastic band on my wrist because I was in emotional distress all the time. And, you know, I learned about, you know, your thoughts lead to your emotions and then behaviors. But then I was like, oh my God, I don't know my thoughts. Because we were talking about earlier, the default mode network, it was just the same thought patterns over a long period of time. And I was using this elastic band not to change, sort of, but it was to draw my attention off. Yeah. So I'd slap it on my wrist like this, and it would kind of get myself out of my head. And I would do that all day, and it actually helped after like a week, 2 weeks. I was slapping it and like thinking about a nice thought or me sitting by the lake, or it was starting to break.
Yes.
And I thought that was a massive game changer for me.
Yeah.
But I haven't done the what you said. What was it?
Just walking. It's fine.
Walking? Oh, yeah, yeah. You said HDMR, I think it was.
Oh, EMDR, sorry.
EMDR? Yeah, yeah. I haven't tried that specifically.
Yeah, so EMDR therapy is emotional desensitization reprogram. I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. There we go. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And for a long time, they actually didn't know why EMDR was working so amazingly, but it helps to reprocess trauma and thoughts without the fear attachment to it.
Right.
And back in 2000, 2018, a paper came out from, can't remember the first name, but the surname is De Vogt, 2018. And they basically showed that lateral eye movement deactivates the amygdala. And what's funny is in the discussion part of the paper, they actually write, they go, I think we've just figured out how EMDR works by accident, which is pretty amazing.
Cool.
Yeah, the study was done in rats. And yeah, it sort of started, you know, it served as a springboard for further research into showing that EMDR, why it works is that it helps to deactivate the amygdala. So you can talk about and think about all these feelings without that emotional charge attached to them.
Right, because the amygdala takes over and... Yes. Would you recommend when people are in those states of anxiety that seem uncontrollable to, I guess that's my question. When they're in those states, what would you recommend? Would you, because I always think for me and what I've seen with clients, short utterances from the cognitive brain helped with me when it came, like not giving, not investing too much into the anxiety and saying, you know what, if it kills me, let it kill me. I don't care, you know, so what? It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
Does that help people? And what else could be?
Yeah. So what you're referring to is top-down regulation, which means it's your brain trying to regulate your sympathetic or your system. Mm. Now that could work if you have already, if you're well-versed in that. And what I mean is when your body is in a sympathetic state, fight or flight, let's take it back to primitive times. Your brain is not going to be concerned with why is there a lion here. It's going to be concerned with getting away from it. And if your system has triggered a stressful response, your anxiety has triggered a stressful response, and you've got cortisol and adrenaline, it is going to be hard to talk yourself out of it. You can't really reason with yourself, but you can if you have done that before, in the sense that you know that the outcome is not as catastrophic as you always make it out to be. The quickest way to actually regulate your central nervous system back to a parasympathetic state, which is calmness, and then you can reason, is the physiological sigh. So the double inhale, long exhale, you already elucidated to that. You listened to Dr. Andrew Huberman. He's actually conducted this research in his lab, and they showed that it's the quickest way to recover. So double inhale, little pause at the top. So pause and then long exhale. And then you can kind of reason with yourself. So it depends on how, where you are on that spectrum. So let's say you're at the point where your stress levels are so high that it feels like there's a lion in the room. That's going to be very different to, okay, I feel panicky, but I can talk myself out of it. So I would say that what you've just said would work depending on where you are.
Absolutely. You know, it's a combination of both, sounds like. Yeah. It's like even maybe bottom up first.
Yes.
And then
top down. Like exactly.
Breathe in and then get the mind working and view that situation more as maybe something you have power over. And it's sort of like reflected in the journaling you were talking about, where I like, for me, when it comes to journaling, when I simplify the negative thought on paper, and I don't mean, it's important to not go, oh, I'm scared and I'm feeling this and this and this. It's important to say, okay, what is it? What's the fear at a very simplistic level? Like I fear going to the mall because of the anxiety. And then the next question I always recommend that people write down is, well, what can I do about that?
Mm.
Right. And give yourself, because that's a loaded question. Like we were talking about earlier, giving yourself an option.
Yeah.
Or like that it doesn't have to control you.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. A backup. Yeah.
A backup.
Yeah. When I have a weird anxiety about running. Because I'm afraid of being too far away from home, and I don't know what it is. I'm more than happy to drive. I just need to be somewhere where I've got an escape route. And I think running freaks me out because I don't know if I'm going to be able to get home, which is silly because I walk all the time. So, it's planning what's going to happen. Okay, I'll be tired. okay, what's the worst that can happen? You call your partner and you ask them to come pick you up, or you get a taxi, or you walk home. And it's just rationalizing myself, what are the problems and the outcomes, and what's the worst case scenario? Because I'm not afraid that anything's going to happen on the run. I'm just afraid of being away from home, which is an irrational thought, right? But it's completely valid at the same time, because that's where anxiety stems from, is these thoughts that we don't have control over. And giving myself, are you still there? I think you froze. Oh, no, I thought you froze. Myself plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D. Why do I feel like this? What's the worst that's going to happen? X, Y, Z. Then I can go for my run, and I feel way clearer about, you know, the whole thing, instead of worrying, oh God, I don't go too far. Sometimes I run a mile in the back and a mile in the back because I'm too scared of doing 2 miles and back.
right. But you're challenging yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you're challenging yourself. And even if it's like that little step or that 1 minute more at the gym, it's like, that's
exactly,
it's all it is. Yeah.
Steps. Yeah. And just reinforcing that.
Reinforcing that. Yeah, absolutely. Nicole, I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much for being here. The book is Rewire,
yes.
Break the Cycle, Alter Your Thoughts, and Create Lasting Change. We can rewire our minds. We can recreate ourselves. Yes. We don't have to settle. I really appreciate you being here. And please share where people can find you, how they can contact you and get the book.
Yes. So the book is available everywhere. You type it into Google, it will come up on your nearest store, but Amazon, I don't know what bookstores you have, but I know the US has Walmart, Barnes and Nobles, Waterstones in the UK. So pretty much everywhere it's available worldwide. And you can find me on Instagram. It's Nicole's Neuroscience with an S, Nicole's Neuroscience. That's my only channel. I've got TikTok, but it's not up and running just yet, but you're welcome to follow me on it. I'm trying my best on there too. Thank you so much for having me, Brad. It's been amazing.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Brad's Powerful Anxiety Recovery Program is now available at unpluganxiety.com. The Anxiety Project Program is downloadable and puts the power of anxiety recovery in your own hands. Visit unpluganxiety.com for more details. Recovery starts now.